morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 244 years ago, on July 2nd, 1776, a small group of terrorists betrayed their country and voted to commit any and all acts of terror and treason which they claimed would be necessary to separate from their government. 2 days later, on July 4th, they publicly declared their intention of betrayal and categorically stated their reasons for turning against their country and threatened to murder or otherwise terrorize all who did not join with them. They began their terrorist acts several years earlier. They burned, looted, tortured, murdered, kidnapped, and held hostage representatives and supporters of their government. They ambushed and killed soldiers and policemen. Several attempts at negotiations only increased their demands and brutality until finally, the previous year, in April 1775, they committed open rebellion by attacking government forces that had been sent to protect loyal citizens from their terrorism. The terrorists cloaked their atrocities and treachery with a specious document that claimed the sanctions of God and the sympathy of humanity. They named their perfidious document a Declaration of Independence. And that was Sons of Liberty. I wrote it 35 years ago in 1985 for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, and I have read it on KMUN quite often. We celebrate Yankee Doodle's Nativity Day this Saturday amidst a raging, deadly pandemic plague, also a possible near-climactic human extinction from our own industry, and more locally, a long-predicted, devastating earthquake and tsunami that will shake, rattle, and drown the Northwest coast any moment now. On top of all that, a renewed nuclear arms race awaits the starting gun. So light the firecrackers. And today is July 2nd, which is really the day in 1776 that our revolutionary ancestors broke with the mother country and declared a revolution, which had already been in progress for more than a year. Even revolutions need a manifesto. And it might be a good idea during these turbulent times to read the Declaration of Independence once again as a reminder of what all the fuss still continues to be about 244 years later. There are a number of assertions that seem quite paradoxical, which the Constitution later attempted to resolve, and especially to bind the separate states as a union rather than a confederation, which the South seceded to revive 80 years later. When you read the Declaration, consider the contradictions and concessions, in particular the denial to abolish black slavery, which the Southern colonies refused to endorse and would not as a whole join the revolt against King and Mother Country if even a mention of slavery appeared in the Declaration. That was the fiercest argument of all and the most egregious omission, which ultimately caused the Civil War. The USA is once more in bitter strife over much the same issue of racism and prejudicial and arbitrary governance nearly 2.5 centuries later. Are we about to dissolve the bonds of amicable American unity? I would like to read now something I wrote. I call it Democracy's Day. July is a month in which the USA celebrates its birth of liberty, equality, and justice for all. Larger voices proclaim America as the freest, most wonderful nation on earth, and unfurl the Stars and Stripes banner of worldly preeminence and godly jingoism. There are smaller voices of disagreement, which is not to say that the ideals of freedom are not present within the nation, or that their intent is less than personal and political liberty and equality for all who dwell at present and in the future within its star-spangled sovereignty. It is that the actuality is far less than advertised, that personal and in particular political independence is not the daily reality for millions of American citizens, that the old evils of worth measured by wealth race, and gender continually and persistently erode the foundations that Yankee Doodle America claims to stand upon and believe in. American history boiled to the bone might be encapsulated as war and wealth rather than about liberty and equality, if it is argued that the wars have all been fought for prosperity and property. That would more realistically reconfigure the USA's essential matrix of manifest destiny. This narrow perspective of American patriotism is obviously a gross injustice to those who have struggled and often been jailed, bled, or died for the larger beliefs chronicled in the Declaration of Independence and the later Bill of Rights, the Ten Commandments of American democracy. Yet the very fact of the intensity of the strife for equality and justice within our own Constitution gives legitimacy to the claim that for the powerful elite, wealth and who gets it is the mainspring of the nation's animating force. A paradox that might be worth consideration is that nationalism, which is a hubristic hucksterism that disguises inequities and rot within a nation while simultaneously promoting the pernicious ambitions of a powerful and avaricious few, is prerequisite for both suppression and expansion. And that ideologies, which are fictions masked as ideals, act as justifications for persecution and conquest. The revered ancestors who founded the American nation were well aware that governments are definitively opposed to freedoms of their subjects, essentially mandating they serve and obey. The natural tendency of governance in practice and perception is to rule in its own vested imperative, usually to the detriment of the people destined to inhabit its geography. The original revolutionary visionaries of the founding generation recognized this despotic aspiration of classical 18th century aristocracies, and more remarkably restrained their own ambitions by crafting a form of government that had as its primary authority the subjects it governed. It is the responsibility of the people in a democracy to always contain the power of government, which, without that restraint, will wrest power away from the people, resulting in a demockery. The contradiction has worked imperfectly, even at present, with disreputable people in power who want it all. The system's check and balances frustrates their overt overtures of despotic disruption of life, liberty, and prudence. Democratic freedom implies a mature citizenry. To be free and remain that way is a large responsibility, and many among a democratic citizenry are unsure and uncomfortable with that premise. Freedom is doppelganged, personal and abstract. Freedom insists upon the value of the individual, but the ever-increasing complexity of American society is constructed upon aggregates and masses and renders less valuable the usefulness and contributions of each person, never mind the conglomerations of class constraints. Parasitic governance perpetuates psychological and constitutional cataplexy. Plutocratic governance attempts to make itself seemingly omnipotent to such a degree that average citizens are reduced to economic and utilitarian objects of scarce personal worth. Pedantic government is such a stickler to rigid details that any civic deviation or dissent to its policies or actions is tantamount to treachery. It is exactly such forms of preeminent supremacy and subservience our Enlightenment forebearers attempted to break away from, although some, of course, desire to substitute themselves as the local adherents of authority in the absence of the king's power. A powerful minority of pseudo-Tories from the very beginning of the Republic has insisted that liberty is the property of the elite and that the rest of the unwashed population must be made to serve its interests. These born-again Federalists continue to share a constrained interpretation of the Constitution. Its rights and privileges belong to the wealthy and corporate, its dues and obligations to everyone else. They would like to suspend the Bill of Rights, which their antecedents never approved of except as compromise, and believe that what they piously call original intent of the Constitution's framers, who were all white property or mercantile males, should be its only interpretation. It is an absurd and dangerous, though persistent, notion, contrary to the actual intent of the Constitution's authors, to make it broad and flexible enough to reflect future problems and ideas they knew they were unable to anticipate or were too contemporarily divided in opinion to immediately resolve, among them the crucial impetus to emancipate slaves and women. The Yankee Doodle revolutionaries who wrote the Declaration of Independence and later the Constitution and Bill of Rights knew very well that even the most benign governments eventually and carelessly swallow the rights of their citizens, reflexively perpetuating concentrated authority and subversive elitism. The laws of the Constitution simply make it more difficult for supremacists to make the rest of us so completely their subjects. Quite understandably, Americans have passionately squabbled among themselves from the outset as to exactly what sort of nation the USA is and ought to be. There should be no doubt, despite argument and hyperbole. The people are sovereign. The people possess basic and inalienable rights. These rights are from birth until death. The right to think and speak openly, the freedom of association, of religion, or none, and the only true mandate of government is to secure, protect, and enlarge them. The Bill of Rights were added to the mainframe of the Constitution as its heart, and to give teeth to those inalienable rights, limiting governments and majorities from dissolving liberty and justice for all. We are a democracy because it is necessary. It is not because of beneficent human nature that these latest generations have inherited a few fundamental rights and liberties sought by the mass of humanity for millennia. These limits on power are to curb the avaricious ambitions of many among us, to prevent them from getting their hands on our political autonomy and personal liberation. Our freedoms are, in essence, our obligations, also, to preserve them for our descendants. We are a democracy, yet we have so much to learn about democracy. We have learned that personal and public sovereignty, independence, and equal rights do not come easily or stay for very long without constant nurturing. Political rights and liberties, hard won by one generation, are frequently eroded by their successors, who are too often careless with them, not realizing how rare, necessary, and fragile they actually are. The farther removed we are from the imperatives of our ancestors for freedom and equality, the more we take for granted their struggle to establish our inheritance, and the greater the danger we will allow our heritage to be stolen from us and our heirs. Periods of national crisis reveal the incipient impotence of average citizens, whose input is too often minuscule and impotent. Most citizens are at the bottom of every major crisis, yet are drastically affected by the consequences. Civil liberties are threatened, as are also jobs, homes, and health, and average citizens are made to feel as though they have little say or consequence. Ordinary people are rendered insufficient and inadequate. Yet when the societal ceiling seems to be cracking over the heads of the collective citizenry, it is up to the common, ordinary citizens who are ultimately responsible to prevent the sky from falling down around all and everything. Cities and communities are not simply or even exactly parochial entities concerned only with schools, sewers, streets, and strip malls. They are also integral parts of a political and geographical whole and aptly represent the American person at home and work. It is vital that the communal commons reflect the personal voice of a universal community solidarity and democratization of one for all and all for all. Democracy begins at home, first in the heart and mind. From there, it radiates through the house into the neighborhood and community. democracy conjoins with liberty and freedom. It is the right to not be recognized by gender, race, or class, but by the simple fact of a person's existence on planet Earth. The right to be counted on for personal and independent expression of belief and opinion. The right to be the only person on the planet who believes in something no one else does. Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women, the great jurist Learned Hand said. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. And average citizen James Boyle, who wrote, "One reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." And that was Democracy's Day, which I wrote and have rewritten. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. The Bill of Rights, America's Greatest Afterthought. Whenever I think of the Constitution, I think of the Bill of Rights, guaranteeing our freedoms of speech, religion, the press, fair trials, states' rights, and more. But the backstory of how the Bill of Rights originated was not so familiar, at least not to me. So it came as a shock to find out that the Bill of Rights was, in fact, a reluctant afterthought, a political ploy by the Federalists led by Washington, Hamilton, and Madison. According to Professor Carl Hamilton's 2015 book, The Bill of Rights, Madison's Bill of Rights was more a political strategy than a statement of America's most cherished values. And that's a quote. Let's examine its historical context. 5 days before the end of the Constitutional Convention, September 12, 1787, George Mason of Virginia proposed that a Bill of Rights be added to the Constitution. The delegates, almost to a man, soundly defeated the measure. They were tired. They wanted to go home. The Constitution was already written, and they were probably a bit hungover. The bender that began America, September 17, 1787, involved consumption of 54 bottles of Madeira, Washington's favorite, 60 bottles of claret, 22 bottles of porter, 12 bottles of beer, 8 bottles of cider, and 7 bowls of punch, racking up a bar tab of $17,252 in today's currency for the 55 delegates. As Hamilton later put it in the Federalist, a Declaration of Rights was mere aphorisms, which would sound much better in a treatise of ethics than in a constitution of government, quote unquote. The Federalists did not entirely trust the people and were leery about giving them too many freedoms. Let's not forget that the Constitution was primarily directed toward white male landowners who considered Negroes three-fifths of a human being. Whatever the reasons, the framers had made a serious mistake as the omission of a Bill of Rights had united the anti-federalists and given them ammunition to oppose a Constitution they already mistrusted. To rectify their grievances, the anti-federalists called for a second convention. To prevent a second convention, which would undo everything, and to ensure ratification, the Federalists, led by Hamilton, agreed to add a Bill of Rights. But it would be their Bill of Rights. Written by them, this Bill of Rights would dose out just enough freedoms, quote unquote, to appease the people, quote unquote, cut the anti-federalists off from their base while taking credit for the bill themselves, and at the same time preserve the Constitution as they had written it. As Madison had predicted, the Bill of Rights, with little dissent and little discussion, was passed. But then nobody seemed to care about the Bill of Rights one way or another, including the anti-federalists and the American people. Even Thomas Jefferson, one of the bill's staunchest defenders, seemed to have lost interest. Our beloved Bill of Rights was embedded in a list of laws about fisheries, fishermen, and post office roads. Unlike the day-long celebrations of parades and fireworks that commemorated the signing of the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776, and the ratification of the Constitution, July 4th, 1788, the passage of the Bill of Rights was met with complete indifference. March 1st, 1792, the day the new nation got its long-awaited Bill of Rights, became a day forgotten in American history. How ironic for that now cherished pillar of protection for individual liberties. The March 1st, 1792 announcement did not even make the front pages of newspapers, but was buried among advertisements for raw land and cough syrups. It would take the Civil War, the 14th Amendment, and 200 years to make the Bill of Rights finally and truly relevant. In a 1789 letter to James Madison, Noah Webster remarked, "Paper declarations of rights are trifling things and no real security to liberty." How quaint. That was by Dr. Robert Brake. The Bill of Rights, America's Greatest Afterthought. Dr. Brake lives in Ocean Park, Washington. On a personal note, I shipped aboard a Navy troop vessel with a bunch of other USMC jarheads from Okinawa to Vietnam in March 1966, which was named after a signer of the Declaration of Independence, George Clymer, who was a Philadelphia merchant. He also signed the Constitution. He and George Washington were apparently good friends. The USS Clymer was an old beat-up bucket that had been a banana boat in the Caribbean before the Navy bought it for World War II Pacific Island invasions. It had wood decks and a large Japanese geisha doll in a glass case the crew considered equivalent to a ship's figurehead. The crew not particularly affectionately called the ship the Greasy George because of a ring of oil that usually surrounded its hull in port. The Clymer set out alone, and it took us 5 days to reach Chu Lai, South Vietnam, which was HQ at the time for the 1st Marine Division, which was defending the airstrip there. Hanoi Hana broadcast that North Vietnamese MiGs were going to bomb us while at sea. And this is Michael McCusker. To mask or not to mask? That is the question. If you have a decent opinion of your fellow citizens, you will wear a public mask during this terrible pandemic that has already killed more than 100,000 of our citizenry and most likely will sicken and kill many thousands more. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everybody else. Happy Independence Day.
In '76, the sky was red, thunder rumbling overhead. Bad King George couldn't sleep in his bed, and on that stormy morn, old Uncle Sam was born. Old Sam put on a three-cornered hat, and in a Richmond church he sat, and Patrick Henry told him that while America drew breath, it was liberty or death.
What kind of hat is a three-cornered hat?
Nobody who was anybody believed it. Everybody who was anybody, they doubted it. Nobody had faith. Nobody, nobody but Washington, Tom Paine, Benjamin Franklin, Chaim Solomon, Crispus Attucks, Lafayette, nobody.
Nobody's running a tea party at Boston.
Betsy Ross organized a sewing circle.
Yeah, Paul Revere had a horse race.
and a little ragged group believed it, and some gentlemen and ladies believed it, and some wise men and some fools, and I believed it too. Well, I'll tell you. Now let me...
No, let us tell you!
Then Mr. Tom Jefferson, a mighty fine man, he wrote it down in a mighty fine plan. The rest all sided with a mighty fine man as they crossed their feet and nodded their eyes. Oh, grand the country did arrive!
And a mighty fine idea.
Adopted unanimously in Congress, July 4th, 1776.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with sight unalienable rights.
Among these rights are life.
Yes, sir.
Liberty.
That's right.
And the pursuit of happiness.
Is that what they say?
The very words.
That sure does sound mighty fine.
Building a nation is awful tough. The people found are going rough. The 13 states weren't large enough, so they started to expand.
Still nobody who was anybody believed it. Everybody who was anybody, they stayed at home. But Lewis and Clark and the pioneers, driven by hunger, haunted by fears, the Klondike miners and the 49ers, some wanted freedom and some wanted riches. Some liked to loaf while others dug ditches. And I believe it too, and you know who I am.
No, who are you, mister, anyway?
Well, I started to tell you.
Yes, mister, tell us who you are.
You see, I represent the whole of... That's it. That's the idea.
Old Abe Lincoln was thin and long. His heart was high and his faith was strong. But he hated oppression, he hated wrong. And he went down to his grave to free the slave.
Man in white and
November 19th, 1863, at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
And he was right. I believe that, too.
Gee, mister, we still don't know who you are.
Well, I've been trying to tell you. You see...